get my special powders and to get my feet. Everywhere I go, it rains on me.
Freak Radio 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. This is indeed the Indie Newswire program. We're going to be talking about the case of the West Memphis Three, who are three young men who have been in prison almost 13 years now, who many believe were wrongfully convicted of a triple homicide, which took place in West Memphis, Arkansas. We'll be getting a little bit of discussion about that case today, bringing you some music. We've in fact been listening to a CD which was put out a few years ago, a benefit for Truth and Justice to Free the West Memphis Three, which features many, many artists. We heard a couple tracks from that. Tony Scalzo with Indicted, and started off with Tom Waits with his track Rains on Me. We'll be hearing more from this throughout the first hour of the program. And we will be talking with Angie Vella, who is a San Francisco resident and has been organizing benefits for the West Memphis Three. She'll be joining us in a few moments to give us a little bit of background about the case and why it's important to advocate for justice on their behalf. We'll also be hearing some selections from an event that took place in Santa Cruz about a week ago at The Attic, where Jonathan Richman, legendary musician of Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers fame, gave a talk and presentation, read from Damien Echols' book, one of the West Memphis Three, and also talked about his recent visit with Damien Echols, who is on death row in the state of Arkansas. So we'll be hearing all that today on the program, and we're going to start off with a little more music before we get to that stuff. First, this is from the same CD. This is L7 with The Boys in Black.
Look at the
And that's L7 with the Boys in Black from the Free the West Memphis 3 benefit CD. You're tuned to the Indie Newswire program on Free Radio 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. And today on the program, we're going to be talking about the case of the West Memphis 3 in 1994. Damian Echols, Jason Baldwin, and Jesse Miskelly Jr. were convicted of the vicious slayings of 3 8-year-old boys in West Memphis, Arkansas. Had it not been for 2 HBO documentaries and help from celebrities such as Winona Ryder, Henry Rollins, Eddie Vedder, Metallica, and others, the world might have thought justice was served. But the camera revealed the trials to be bizarre 20th century witch hunts. The teens were convicted with no physical evidence and which should have resulted in mistrials. Echols received the death penalty, Baldwin and Miskelly life imprisonment. We're going to get into a little bit of the specifics now with Angie Vella, who is from Vella Entertainment and Music for Life, a nonprofit that she runs. Angie Vella helps organize many of the events in the Bay Area around the case of the West Memphis 3 to try to raise awareness. And Angie is joining us to talk a bit about the case. Hello, Angie. Are you with us?
I am.
It's a pleasure to have you. Thanks for taking time out to be with us and talk about this important case. Can you give our listeners just a sense of the hysteria that surrounded West Memphis, Arkansas, in the time after these murders took place and then how they were convicted?
Well, it would seem that they were convicted on grounds of wearing black heavy metal t-shirts, specifically Metallica, and because of Damian reading novels from Stephen King and being a little different, long dark hair and wearing lots of black. And therefore, because of that, these murders were done as a satanic ritual. And so at the time, there was a lot of satanic panic scare going around, and they were using that against these three boys and kind of lured them in through Jesse Miskelly, who has an IQ of like 72, and was interrogating him for 12 hours straight without any attorney, parents, or any break with food or drink. So,
what about any other physical evidence that tied these three to the murders? Was anything like that ever presented to a jury?
Some of the evidence that they said they found were fabrics of clothing and a knife that was found behind a house of one of the boys, which was later to find out it was like a dumping spot for anybody, like a dumping hole. And the fabric that they were using could have been any number of people across the United States.
In the movies, the films done by HBO, Paradise Lost 1 and 2, it presents, you know, just sort of the hysteria that surrounded this case. But it also looks at one of the boys who was murdered, his father, as a potential suspect. Can you kind of give our listeners a sense of what's that all about?
John Mark Byers was the father of one of the boys that was, you know, gruesomely mutilated. He had body parts removed and whatnot. And one of the reasons why a lot of people felt like he was a prime suspect, but for some reason has never been really looked at, is he was a drug informant for the West Memphis Police Department. They had found a bloody knife that had both his blood and Christopher Byers' blood on it that he had given to the film crew as a gift. I believe it was during the first film of Paradise Lost. And then also another thing that people are, you know, wanting to find out about is whenever they found out later, when a Berkeley, California investigator came out and noticed that some of the marks on the boys' bodies were teeth marks, he had his entire set of teeth removed, and he said it was somebody had punched him in the face and knocked them all out. But it was just coincidental that it happened during that time. And also, his wife mysteriously died as well. And there's been no conclusion on her death and how she had died.
Now, where is the case at currently? There's been numerous appeals that have taken place over the years, and I believe recently Damian Echols had a petition thrown out by the federal court. Do you have sort of an idea of where the case is at legally?
Well, the only thing I know is in October they were allowed to admit DNA evidence for the first time. And that right now Damien Echols' lawsuit is going through two federal appeals simultaneously. That's where they will be able to give the DNA evidence and any other evidence they have to prove the innocence of the West Memphis 3.
Why do you feel that the case is important for people to know about and to be actively involved in trying to get justice for these three young men?
Well, I mean, if you go to WM3, and that's the number 3.org, and review the case files, all the legal documents that are listed that are public to anyone, you can just look through the case and you'll find out for yourself that it's not a very clear-cut situation where these boys were, you know, put in prison for something they had no evidence on. It's hard to believe that something like this could happen in America, but I know it happens every day to many people. And it's just a matter of, you know, these boys lived in West Memphis, Arkansas, which is a very poverty-stricken area, and they were taken advantage of because they were different. And they were living in the Bible Belt in a very, you know, unusual part of the country.
And it was sort of easy to create a panic around their black clothing and their, you know, the kind of books that they read and their choice of, you know, musical entertainment being heavy metal. It was sort of easy to just sort of have them as a scapegoat. It's, you know, for folks that have not seen the movies Paradise Lost 1 and 2, I do believe that they're available at many local video rental places around town and also at the public library. So you can see those documentaries yourself and see the wealth of evidence that probably implicates another man, John Byers, in the murders. We just have a few moments left for this segment, so maybe, Angie, if you could talk about the significance of June 3rd. It's being billed as a worldwide day of awareness on the West Memphis 3 case. What's being planned around the Bay Area to bring awareness, and what kind of things can our listeners do to help in this case?
On June 3rd, we're having the West Memphis 3 World Awareness Day. So basically, this is going to be a day where states and other countries, you know, globally, people will be able to stage concerts or have, you know, comedians or show the films and have benefits showing, raising awareness and funds for the defense fund of the West Memphis 3. In the Bay Area, we have two shows happening, one at Café du Nord, which is going to be with Dave Dalton, the pastor from Cell Block 5, Black Dahlia of the Dwarves, The Girlfriend Experience, and Mondo Generator. And at this event, there will be raffle items for people to, you know, win items that have been donated by bands or anybody that has been a supporter of the West Memphis 3 has given raffle or auction items. And then on that same date in the Bay Area at the Great American Music Hall, we'll have Matt Gonzalez and Jonathan Richmond speaking, and then the band Tarnation, Chuck Prophet, and Mark Kozlik will be performing at the Great American Music Hall to bring awareness and raise funds also for the West Memphis 3. And that's it for the Bay Area, but there are things happening globally for the West Memphis 3 to raise funds and awareness. And so, best, you know, people can come out and support it. We have letters. We would have letters there for people to review that have been written by Jason Baldwin. He's urging people to write to Huckabee, the governor of Arkansas, and asking him to look at the case again. He's been kind of ignoring this case for some time, and he doesn't have any reason to, because there's no evidence for him to not, you know, question why they should be in prison. So basically that's it in the Bay Area.
Great. And is there any local contacts for folks if they want to help organize other events, maybe in Santa Cruz or in help out with these events going on in the Bay Area, or should they just contact you through the West Memphis 3 website?
It's best just to contact me through the West Memphis 3 website. I do events pretty regularly now for the West Memphis 3. I just had an art exhibit for Damien Echols' premier art showing, and in San Francisco, and I'm going to be continuing to show his artwork around the Bay Area.
Great. Well, again, for our listeners, that website is WM3, and that's the number 3, WM3.org. Angie Vella, I appreciate your time today and all the work you've been doing to raise awareness on this case and for with us. You're tuned to 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. This is the Indie Newswire show, and in just a few moments, we're going to be hearing some excerpts of an event that took place this past week in Santa Cruz at the Attic on Pacific Avenue. We'll be hearing from Jonathan Richman, legendary singer, songwriter with the Modern Lovers, as well as his own music. But he spoke about his recent visit with Damien Echols on Death Row, as well as read from his book. And we'll also be hearing a few other things that happened that night as well. So stand by for that in just a few moments here on the Indie Newswire show.
Overview of the case is on May 6, 1993, 3 8-year-old boys were found brutally murdered in the Robin Hood Hills of West Memphis, Arkansas, which is across the river from Memphis, Tennessee, across the Mississippi River. Steve Jones, a juvenile probation officer who happened to be at the scene when the bodies were discovered, immediately directed the West Memphis police's a focus of attention towards Damien Echols as the only person in town capable of committing such crimes. Jones had previously had a fixation with looking for a crime to pin on Damien, whom he viewed as a sinister teenager who must be the leader of a satanic cult. The type of evidence which led Jones to this conclusion, and which was actually later presented by the prosecution at Damien's trial, included Damien's wearing of black clothes and heavy metal t-shirts, reading Stephen King novels, and an interest in the Wicca religion. Rumors ran rampant around town, and crowds of angry locals, driven by rumors of cults, threw rocks at the defendants at their trial and told the media their own tall tale stories. Other possible suspects weren't seriously investigated, including Mark Byers, the stepfather of one of the victims. He was both a career criminal and a drug user, who also had ongoing connections to the police as a drug informant. And there's a case of a local restaurant manager who, a few hours after the boys were last seen alive, reported a dazed man covered in blood as having been in the women's bathroom there for about an hour. The police officer who responded to the call didn't even leave her vehicle to investigate. And later, although detectives later, not that day, at a later time, they collected blood scrapings from the bathroom, the samples were lost. So although there was no evidence of cult activity in the area and no evidence to connect Damien to the murders, rumors, irresponsible police work, and the media created an environment where it was decided Damien and two friends, Jason Baldwin and Jesse Miskelly Jr., must be devil worshippers who are guilty of the murders. Some see them as scapegoats for a community uncomfortable with looking under the surface of their supposedly normal town. Leading to the implication of Damien, Jason, and Jesse was Vicki Hutchison, a disturbed woman in trouble for passing bad checks and possibly interested in reward money. She and her young son reported witnessing bizarre scenarios involving some aspects of the crimes, but went before what anyone's conception of possible reality was, including the police and prosecution, who used their testimony anyway. After Damien received the death penalty and Jason and Jesse life sentences, she recanted, saying she had basically said what the West Memphis police wanted her to say. She reported that she'd been too drunk to actually remember the cult meeting she'd talked about, where she was supposedly at with the suspects. She couldn't even remember being there, much less who she was there with. She later asked, "Why are three boys behind bars when police had much more evidence on Mark Byers than the three?"
1, 2, 3, 4. Almost every day I see the same face on broken picture tube. It fits the attitude. If you could see yourself, you'd put you on a shelf.
Your verbal
masturbate
promise to nauseate. Today I'll play the part of non-parent. Not make a rules for you to know about yourself. Not lie. Seem to wonder why hundreds of people die. You're riding tickets, man.
Five off the jump!
Now I'll play a public servant to serve and protect by the law and the state. I bust the punks that rape, steal, and Jamaica boy, some things you can enjoy because of heaven and hell. A fucking Wednesday. They put it in your head, then put you in your bed.
Watch him, honey. Stay in your prayer.
God is everywhere!
Now I'll play a man learning priesthood. I question things because I am human and call my father close to the stranger.
I won't be back
to see.
Freak Radio 101.1 FM. This is the Indie News Wire show. That was Kelly Deal with Fucking Hostile off the Free the West Memphis 3 CD. Right before that, we heard a little segment, an introduction from last week's event at the Attic, where Jonathan Richmond gave a little presentation on his visit with Damien Eccles. We're going to be hearing some of that momentarily. We also heard The Truth by Steve Earle from the first track off the CD for the Free the West Memphis 3. So we're going to hear now a selection that Jonathan Richmond picked to read from Damien Eccles' book, Almost Home, My Life Story, Volume 1 by Damien Eccles. And this is a selection that Jonathan read last week at the Attic. Here it is.
This narrative would not be complete without a word about Lakeshore itself. People who have seen it in the many years I've been locked up have told me that it's changed quite a bit, that it's no longer the same place. Now it's clean. The people plant flowers in their yards and they wash their cars. People are neighborly and friendly, and even cops live there. Old people live there after they've retired. I suppose it is now to be considered lower middle class. That's a big difference from the days when I knew it. To hear of those changes saddens me because I feel that the last vestiges of what I knew as home are now gone. The world has moved on while I've been left behind these walls. I no longer feel as if I have any roots. It seems that there's a whole new world out there, and I've become an old man in body and mind, if not in years. Lakeshore was a pretty big place as far as trailer parks go. It consisted of about 200 trailers, give or take a few. They were nearly all run down and beat up, having put their best days long behind them. Nearly every one of them had a small yard surrounded by a metal chain-link fence. The majority of these fences held dogs, which were the only form of home security that we knew. Without a dog and a fence, it was only a matter of time before everything in your yard was stolen and the gas was sucked right out of the tank of your car. The latter was accomplished with nothing more than a piece of hose and a bucket. The heart of Lakeshore was indeed a lake. A lake so green and scummy that most fish no longer inhabited it, and you were strongly advised against swimming in it because it wasn't wise to swallow any of the water. The bottom of the lake was an old boneyard of newspaper machines, wheelbarrows, box springs, and mattresses, rusted bicycles, tangled fish line, busted tackle boxes, broken fishing poles, and anything else your mind could conceive of. Before we went on trial, the cops claimed they found a knife there. I don't doubt that at all, and I would not be completely surprised if they found a dozen more. My attorneys thought it was most likely planted there to make me look bad, which could very well be true. I also believe it's just as likely to have been dumped there by one of the many people who use the lake as their own personal garbage dumpster. That lake was a monster. I miss it terribly now. I now think of it as being beautiful in its own green, scummy way, although I can understand why those who lack my nostalgia would not. In my mind, that lake has become like the Ganges, capable of washing away the pain, fear, suffering, and misery caused by 11 years of incarceration for something I didn't even do. That lake has become a magical thing to me now and has come to represent home more than the Mississippi itself. The streets around this trailer-lined lake bore the weight of a constant parade of stray dogs, shifty teenagers, and shady characters. It was what one might picture upon hearing the words bad neighborhood. It wasn't safe to be caught alone day or night. Roaming packs of hooligans tended to congregate around the small store at the entrance of Lakeshore, which contained two pool tables, a couple of video games, and a jukebox. You could purchase beer in cans or bottles, soft drinks, ditto, boxes of cereals, or the makings of a fine bologna sandwich. On the counter was a fishbowl filled with loose, stale cigarettes of every brand, all to be had for 10 cents each. There were also several coin-operated washing machines and dryers in which to do your laundry, but you had to have a sharp eye or else your unmentionables fell prey to theft. Jason and I spent a few idle hours there, along with his younger brother Matt and a few other neighborhood characters. After several years of seeing nothing but empty fields and crop dusters, this place seemed like a pretty happening spot. As long as you kept your eyes to yourself and didn't try to mind anyone else's business, you were fine. Anything else was asking for a fight. Some unknown marketing genius had given this establishment the quaint title of the Lakeshore Stop and Shop, but I never heard a single soul refer to it as anything other than the store. And that's it.
Jonathan Richman reading from Damien Eccles' book. We're going to hear now a bit of Q&A with Jonathan and the audience about his recent visit with Damien Eccles a few months ago. So here is that audio next.
My drummer Tommy and I went back east. We're musicians. We played back near Arkansas. So we took the time to visit Damien Eccles. We couldn't see everybody in one day. It's in this remote location. We were there talking to him for about a half hour. The guards were actually nice to us. We got there late enough so that they didn't have to allow us to speak to them at all. But since they could see that we tried to get there on time and visiting hours, they actually gave us some extra time after visiting hours ended. He had quite a presence, seeing him. It was behind plexiglass. You didn't get a chance to shake hands or anything like that. And you could hear him pretty well. I don't know that they had little microphones or whatever, but we just asked him some questions about how he was doing. And among other things, we asked if he felt that his being so outspoken about the bad conditions had hurt him, had made guards resent him. And he said yes, but he felt also that that was the reason why his treatment got slightly better. He says it seems to him that what people were most afraid of as far as practitioners of illegal, in other words, guards doing illegal abuse to prisoners, what it seemed to him was most threatening to them was being known, having it come to the light of day. He said they did take it out on, I guess, especially Jason Baldwin, since he's not quite as high profile as Damien. They would take away his privileges and go back to Damien and says, see, that's what we did to your friend because of you talking. But apparently his talking about the conditions had saved himself, at least from some more severe abuse. Any questions? Yeah, Les was asking, mentioning that it seems that he's grown when you see him films. I was noticing that when you see him in the earlier years and then you see him later, they all seem to have grown, and that was more so when you saw them in person. Yeah, he's written 5 books by hand in prison. He seems very serious about working on himself. Yes, that was one of the main impressions that you got from seeing him, is that he was dead serious. He was not what you'd call a slacker. He took his prison time really serious as chances to improve himself. And he read as much as he possibly could and just did other things, meditated a lot, studied a lot. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah,
he seemed definitely to have the air of a person who had grown and not too bitter a person considering. He seemed to take it as opportunities to grow. That's the impression I got, yes. When you see him, as far as I could tell, with one eye, one look told you he didn't do it. It was that. It was like they had a great statesman in jail, is what it looked like. He was a little rough around the edges. He was wearing a prison outfit. He wasn't all smiley and happy all the time. He seemed real sincere, real straightforward, no fooling around. There wasn't even a question of it. He became like a pal, is what it was. And not just in a familiar way. He was someone that you respected. At least that's what I got. Yes, very much. In a nutshell, one look tells you didn't do it. The question was he still able to be optimistic after all these rough years? Was he still able to hold on to that? And the answer is yes. He had this great smile, this little smile. Like he would say things, we would talk about movies and things, and he would say things like, I suppose I'll watch anything as long as it's got a monster in it. And his eyes would get brighter and everything, and he had this little smile on his face. Yeah, he was way natural. Occasionally you could see he would get angry when, I mean, the guards, some of them are nice, some of them aren't. So it's just like any other thing. And when you have a person who's not nice in a guard uniform, he has power to make your life a little rough, especially if you're under his control 24 hours a day for years at a time. So occasionally some of them, you might say, abuse the privilege. And yeah, you could see he was, to say the least, a bit annoyed sometimes. But he talked about that too. He's read experiments. He says you take, you know, average people, do experiments, put guard uniforms on them, and tell them you're doing an experiment. And this has been repeated in colleges and all kinds of places. Take 20 college students, all of a sudden put a guard outfit on them and tell them that they're responsible, even though they know it's a game. Maybe you've all heard of these kinds of experiments. People don't do too well. Average person, you tell them that they're all of a sudden a guard, and their behavior becomes abusive pretty fast. So he was in that sense forgiving. He didn't blame the guards as being personally bad people, but he felt that that's the kind of abuse that happens with that kind of power to almost anyone. So I wouldn't say he was bitter. Yeah, I would say he could keep smiling and, well, you know, not always, but it was there. And considering the circumstances, how bad were the circumstances, Jonathan? Worse in some ways than I thought. Not in kind of a rat-infested hellhole way that you'd think, maybe, but in a sterile, mechanical, plexiglass, plastic, no-touch, no-contact way. It was even a little rougher to see it than to think about it. It makes your heart hurt a little. At least, it's that kind of rough. And considering he's in that kind of no touch, no color monstrosity of a place, which was built to punish people, it was built as a big punishment block. But since they wanted to keep the money, and it's that situation where if the state doesn't use it, they'll lose grants or something from the feds. So they had to keep the prison used, even though it wasn't appropriate to the kind of prisoners being put there. So they put them there anyway. It's a very harsh place. And so considering that, he's doing good. I think there's some contact once in a while. They get to go out to a sort of an exercise yard, but even that isn't outside. They have some sort of a grain silo where there's all kinds of maybe rats and there's pigeons and stuff. No outside activity other than that. And I think he gets to see some of the prisoners some of the time, but not generally. It's very solitary and very harsh. He wants to know how I got involved. There's a musician in San Francisco named Chuck Prophet, a pal. He was putting together, actually wasn't putting together, he was a musician. Angie over there, I do believe you had... That was your deal, yeah, Angie? So Angie. We have Angie to thank for a lot of this stuff. Angie organized that and it ended up happening at the Swedish American Hall downtown San Francisco on Market Street. And I had heard of them as the three kids with the Metallica T-shirts. And I was pretty sure that I didn't know what I thought of them other than I knew that there was some kind of railroading being going on, but I really didn't know anything about them. Then after that, we saw the films and any of you have seen the films, then you go, oh my goodness. And so, really, that's it. And then we started getting more involved. Me and Nicole started getting more involved, asking people. We sent a little contribution. So Damien's wife, Laurie, wrote back to us and thanked us. And then we had her as a contact. So we said, look, me and Tommy are going to drive through the East Coast and the South. Is it possible to visit the prisoners? And so that's more or less like that. Anyone else? And he's asking if Damien had anything to say about Mark Barnes. We kept it kind of light, you know what I mean? We asked him what he was eating and stuff. Actually, it's pretty bad, but the prison does have its own garden, and if you can eat the, you know, just raw cauliflower or whatever it is, they cook it up, and he says that it's always kind of dirty, and they got some grasshoppers and stuff in there. And I say, look, I'm all in favor of being a vegan myself, but let's face it, if it's grasshoppers is the protein source, and they're already dead anyway, eat your vegetables. So the food ain't great. If you don't eat your vegetables, it's like Skittles and a bunch of... And he also said that there's a sorry situation where they don't feed you properly, and people end up sort of bribing people to get their appropriate rations. It's not very nice. But they got those vegetables. Yeah, they got a few bugs in them, but what else is new? All right, anyone else? I'm telling you, he could smile. We were prepared for him to look much harsher and more serious considering the circumstances. Were you here when I was just saying that to be physically in that is kind of a little worse than I can describe? Yes, considering it sort of stuns you. It makes you sort of a little bit want to cry. Imagine in the awesomeness of the... How can I put it? It's sort of like being in a big cinder block cage with cinder block and plexiglass, all sterile and modern. And that's it. You know? What can I tell you? Considering that, it seems he can talk, he can joke, he can write books, he can meditate. I'd say he's doing pretty good. He doesn't seem like a weak-minded person who would do something depraved like this. He seems very disciplined, very strong. I know that the two aren't necessarily the same thing. Maybe disciplined person could, but I'm saying is he seems healthy in a way that you can't imagine someone like that doing something so revolting and unhealthy.
And that was Jonathan Richmond recounting his experiences with his visit on death row to Damien Eccles in Arkansas. You're tuned to 101.1 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is the Indie Newswire show. Just a couple more quick things here. There were a couple letters read by the host of the program last week, and I want you to hear those now. They're letters written from Damien Eccles and also from Jason.
So from Damien and his wife, Lori. Dear friends and supporters, we've reached a critical point in Damien's case and are looking to prepare his appeal for federal court. His case was recently dismissed by the Arkansas State Supreme Court, and the federal petition is due within a few months. We've retained new counsel who's an expert at post-conviction appeal work. Funds are needed to pay legal fees that will ensure a complete record for Damien. This is his last chance. More than ever, we need your help. Thanks to everyone who has helped in the past, it's because of your support we're able to continue this fight for justice. Your past donations have enabled us to make strides in investigation for all three cases and will help fund the testing of evidence for DNA. You're amazing, and we're eternally grateful for your help. This is a letter that Jason sent out recently asking, and this was his idea that he had. Dear supporters of the West Memphis Three, a friend and I were chatting this weekend when she brought up an important issue. With Awareness Day fast approaching, what is being planned for Arkansas? After all, this state needs to be everyone's focal point. She proposed a brilliant idea, which I want to pass on to you. I know many of you over the past decade or so have literally inundated the governor's office with letters. How many letters have been sent? Well, it could be anyone's guess. I don't believe anyone is keeping a record. And, of course, the governor's office keeps an apparently endless supply of those rubber-stamped form letters to everyone, which everyone receives in response. So the idea is this. We all write another letter to the governor of Arkansas, but wait. This time, instead of mailing these letters directly to his office, we address them to the post office box listed below like this. The letters need to be brief, polite, and focused. Governor Huckabee says he hasn't seen proof of our innocence. Is he satisfied with the proofs of our guilt? Tell him what fact of this case troubles you most. Stress how important it is for him to be well informed. And don't wait. There isn't much time. Please write that letter today.
And the address is, just address it to Write to Freedom, W-R-I-T-E, like write, like to write a letter. Write to Freedom. Attention, Governor Mike Huckabee, P.O. Box 7406, Little Rock, Arkansas. And that's A-R in postal code, capital A, capital R. And the zip is 72217. So once again, address your letters, Write to Freedom. Attention, Governor Mike Huckabee, P.O. Box 7406, Little Rock, Arkansas, A.R., 72217. And we're going to end now with one final appeal from Damian Echols himself. If you go to the WM3 website, that's WM3.org, the West Memphis 3 website, there's a link to a MySpace webpage, which features a video of Damian Echols, and we'll hear that now.
Hello again, everyone. I guess I'd just like to say thank you again to everyone for not losing interest and for staying on board, for keeping up with things, and for continuing to support us the way you have for the past 13 years now. It's appreciated more than I could ever even begin to tell you. It's a huge force in my life, and I'm sure it is in Jason's and Jesse's as well. It's what gets us through the day. It's what keeps us from losing hope. Just the belief that because of your support, because of your interest, and because of your love, that one day we'll be out of here. And I just want to thank you again for that. Thank you.
That was Damian Echols on death row in the state of Arkansas. He's the alleged ringleader who was sentenced to death. Jesse Miss Kelly and Jason Baldwin make up the West Memphis Three. The other two were sentenced to life in prison. The case has received considerable attention, and many critics charge that the arrests and convictions were miscarriage of justice inspired by a misguided moral panic and that the defendants were wrongfully convicted. June 3rd marks the 13th anniversary of those arrests, and which led to their conviction. For murders they did not commit. It is being billed West Memphis 3 Worldwide Awareness Day, and it is the perfect opportunity for you to join with the supporters of the West Memphis 3 and let the world know the truth about this case and their unjust convictions. So again, there's going to be some events happening in the Bay Area June 3rd. So you can check out WM3.org for that. And of course, look for Paradise Lost if you need to get more information about the case. If you still have a little bit of doubt about the situation that these three men are in, go to the library or go to your video store and ask them for Paradise Lost 1 or 2. There's two films. The first one is just Paradise Lost, the case of the West Memphis 3, and then Paradise Lost 2 Revelations. And you'll see for yourself the historic miscarriage of justice that took place in their case. So we're going to wrap up this segment now with the latest from the latest Alkaline Trio album. They have a track on it called Prevent This Tragedy, and it's about the West Memphis 3. So let's check that out now. Freak Radio, Indie Newswire, 101.1